Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Four years ago, Beth Myers and I only knew each other by reputation. She was the senior advisor for Mitt Romney's campaign for president, and I was the senior strategist for Barack Obama's reelection campaign. And I only got to know Beth at campaign recap forums after the election, and we became really good friends. And I saw in her someone who was deeply passionate about politics for the right reasons. I didn't agree with her on a bunch of stuff, but I really came to admire her and her career in politics. She's now a member of the advisory board of the Institute of Politics. She's been a fellow at the Institute of Politics. I sat down with her the other day to talk about the state of the Republican Party in this very interesting election. Beth Myers, my friend, it's good to see you. I can't help but think what we were doing 4 years ago when you were working for Mitt Romney and I was working for Barack Obama. I must say, I kind of like having this perspective right now, but I'm sure I'm speaking for you as well.
Absolutely. This is a presidential race I'm not terribly unhappy to be sitting out of.
We're going to get to that, but I want to start by asking you about your beginnings in politics. You moved around. You lived in Ohio. You were born in North Carolina, lived in Ohio, and went to Tufts in Massachusetts. Were you always interested in politics? Was that something that you knew you wanted to do?
No. I was an English major at Tufts. My family, yes, my dad was a professor at Ohio State University and then left that when I was 9 years old. And we went.
What did he teach?
Mechanical engineering. So
the apple fell English far and, from English and mechanical engineering, the typical entryways into politics.
Right. Yeah. Both my parents are from West Virginia, and I spent a lot of my summers there. And so a lot of my formative thoughts came from the time I spent in West Virginia. And my grandfather there was very active in politics at a local level. He was in Roane County, West Virginia, which was sort of a lone outlier Republican county.
Yeah, West Virginia was very Democrat.
Very Democrat then. Roane County was very Republican. And you could tell the difference when you entered Roane County because the roads got, highways got a little bumpier. I went to Tufts, was an English major. I was not a young Republican. My boyfriend was in a rock band, and I worked putting myself through college in a live music club. So I spent most of my nights, in one way or another, at clubs.
And then Ronald Reagan was kind of a rock star for you.
Yeah, I kind of got interested in politics in the late 70s, there was a great conservative intellectual movement. I mean, I was reading people like Dictators and Double Standards by Jean Kirkpatrick and William F. Buckley, early George Will stuff. And there was just a lot of interesting ideas, the Viennese economists. I mean, once you kind of started going down that rabbit hole, Ayn Rand's fiction, all that was really great. When I was taking classes, I took a lot of philosophy classes, and the 20th century Marcuse, Foucault, they just didn't resonate with me at all. And I started reading conservative writers, and I thought, yeah, I get this. And it really turned me on. And I was working at this bar, and one of the bartenders was hired by John Connolly for president. And he had talked to me, knew I was a Republican too, or a conservative. And since I was the only other conservative he knew, he asked if I wanted to work on the presidential campaign.
Not a lot of conservatives on the Tufts campus?
No, and this was a bar between Harvard Square and Central Square. So we were right in the thick of things. in Cambridge. And so he asked me if I wanted... He
so you
called
me. Did you keep the conservative thing on the down low? Would it have hurt your tips?
No, nothing would have hurt my tips. It was loud music. There weren't a lot of conversations about...
I see.
Okay. About philosophical things at Jack's Bar in Cambridge in the 70s. But he called me and said, when I was actually on a shift at the bar, and said, would you be interested in working for the John Connolly for President? I said, sure. And he said, well, we're on our way over. I'm over on my way over with Chip Andrews, and we'll interview you. And so I was interviewed for my first presidential campaign wearing a rugby shirt and jeans, and they hired me. And it was great
fun.
In
a bar? Did they interview you there?
Pretty much in the bar, hired in the bar, quit the bar that night after, and then went to work on the campaign. And
the way that thing ended, you probably ended up in a bar too. Right?
Ended up in a bar. Actually,
I mean,
we had a great time.
You raised a lot of dough.
It was a wonderful experience because I'm still one of the people that I worked with on that campaign was Charlie Baker, who is now our governor of
Massachusetts. Yeah.
And dare I say, the most popular governor in the United States, and doing a fantastic job. So as in politics, the people that you meet along the way are wonderful and you know have interesting futures, and you don't know it then, but it was really fun. That was working with Charlie back when we were puppies was a lot of fun. And then I sort of raised my hand to the Reagan campaign and said, hey, that was kind of a fun job, so I'd love to come and work for you guys. And they hired me.
You weren't the only one, right? Didn't Jim Baker move from, wasn't he with John Connolly?
No, James Brady was.
Brady, I mean.
Yeah, and
Brady,
actually that Jim, was the James person Brady, that yeah. I had met and reached out to him.
Jim Brady, who was really, really well-liked press secretary for John Connolly.
Wonderful.
And got embraced by Reagan.
And so he was the person actually, originally had reached out to. I got hired by the Reagan folks. They thought that the right place to send a person who had never been west or south of Ohio was Texas. And so off I went. My father gave me really good advice. It was, the worst thing.
You think they thought that he was going to do so well down there that you couldn't screw it up?
It was a battleground state. Look, there was one elected statewide.
That's true. At that time,
John Tower was the senator, and Bill Clements was the first Republican governor since
Reconstruction.
Texas
hadn't turned yet.
No, it had not. But my boss was Carl Rove, and he did...
Was Carl working exclusively in Texas then?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Carl was the head of Texas Victory Committee, TVC. We worked in a funeral home.
sounds kind of portentous, doesn't it?
Really weird. Yeah. But the Victory Committee was in the basement where the slab was. There was still a slab, and that was somebody's desk, which is really creepy. And the first floor, and then the second floor was the Reagan campaign. And so it was a big deal. The governor of Texas put his name on the line. His friend George Bush was the VP. And he went all out.
Bill Clements.
Yeah. And his wife, Rita, both powerful forces in the Republican Party, in the Republican Party of Texas, and getting it to the state to change from D to R. And my job was to get out the vote in all of the non-urban counties.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was and non-urban meaning outside of Dallas, Fort Worth,
Houston.
San Antonio, and Houston. Mm-hmm. And I traveled all over that state, and I got to know
which
Texas.
Is a big state.
It's a huge state. I got to know those counties like the back of my hand. And went back and worked there in 82 for Governor Clements' reelection when he lost, and then again in 86 when he won.
Good experience, isn't it?
Loved it. I mean, there was nothing better than, diving right in.
What'd you learn from Carl?
Well, Carl was one of, I feel very lucky. I had three mentors, and I'll tell you about all three of them. But Carl was the first, and what I learned from Carl was details and determination. I mean, he was just the same as he is, and enthusiasm. He was determined to win that state for Ronald Reagan, and we were not going to leave a single stone unturned. He would come into my office and ask me about how we were doing in Comanche County. And if I didn't know it off the top of my head, you know, he won.
He said, "You see that slab down there?"
Yeah. So, you know, I at the end of the campaign, I put together this notebook for him, which is half handwritten because, you know, we were, that's the way you did it in 1980. There wasn't right. computers or anything. And I was clearing things out and I found that the other day. And, you know, I looked at it, I thought.
Folks here in Chicago didn't keep any notes, but I'll take your word for it.
It hasn't changed. Things haven't changed that much. I mean, there was a lot, you know, voter contact was, yeah. you know, we were looking for the way to touch people in the most personal way you could. And
that's really, I think what people don't understand is that what what social media allows you to do and what data allows you to do, what mobile communications allows you to do is actually connected to what you did back in the yeah. 80s and what people have been doing for hundreds of years, which is going door to door and making the case. It's just you have a lot more information with which to approach those doors about the voter and who might be receptive to your message.
I mean, we were doing something very sophisticated at the time. We were collecting the data that we got from our phone banks and sending different letters. So if you were an undecided voter, you got a different letter than right. if you were a favorable voter, and they were all hand addressed. That was really a very progressive step in voter contact at the time.
Yeah. And I'm interested, what caused you to put your hand up for Reagan? He was going to be the nominee, so that alone could have been that. But was there something about Reagan that you found particularly inspiring? Because a lot of people, yeah. conservatives today who are people like you, leaders in the Republican Party, point to Reagan the way Democrats like me of a certain age point to John F. Kennedy
right.
and say, that's why I got into politics. Or why I got enthused about it.
Yeah, after the primary campaign, it seemed like I was, of course, 23. I was not caught up in anything very sophisticated level.
You weren't the strategist for the campaign.
No. And it seemed like the normal thing to do. Okay, my guy lost. I want to go work for the guy that won. And mm-hmm. there was I was welcomed, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
There was like, of course, well, you know, we've got somebody who actually learned how to do this stuff.
Well, Reagan embraced George H.W. Yeah. Bush as his vice presidential nominee. He got Jim Baker, not Jim Brady, but Jim Baker
right.
as well in the deal. And did embrace a lot of the Republican Party.
And it
talent
was a big
and establishment.
Tent. Yeah, I mean, it was a big tent. Remember, that was sort of, there was no sense of exclusion. There was no sense of, if you're not with us 100%, you're not with us enough. If you were with, you know, Reagan famously said, if you're with me 80%, you know, you're with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very, very natural thing to do. I never felt like I was one of the Connolly people. I was a Reagan person from the minute that I raised my hand, and that was great. It was a lot of fun.
And you went to Washington after that?
No, never worked in Washington.
Uh-huh.
After that, I went to work for the second.
You stayed in Texas?
No, I left.
All right, I'll stop guessing. Why don't I let you answer the question?
I went back to Boston for a few months actually, I don't know how many months, but and then I went to work at Market Opinion Research in Detroit for Bob Teeter,
yeah.
Second
one of the
man
really,
that I
really. Yeah, towering figures in Republican polling.
Yeah, he was the person that I really, another person that I view as one of my mentors, and absolutely a towering figure, respected, you know, a man of impeccable integrity. And I actually learned at Market Opinion Research. I was doing, they had a
specific. How'd you end up there? Did you know you wanted to go into polling or?
No, and I wasn't actually there for polling, although I went there. They were doing a project on Get Out the Vote and voter contact out of their polling firm. They were trying sort of expand mm-hmm. their service line. And I did that in 82, and I was the, and they kept me on. And I learned at that, from you know, in 83, how to do polling, and I learned how to pull tables, and I learned a little bit about statistics, and I learned a little bit about sampling, which at that point was done with a bunch of phone books in a room.
Yeah.
And it was a great education.
Yeah, that's valuable experience.
Yeah, I mean, I learned polling from, you know, a true pollster, a statistician who had a team of statisticians, Fred Steeper, Alex Gage, Will Feltus.
Right.
These are all guys. And
these guys, just for those who don't know, these guys were sort of the go-to guys in Republican polling in their generation, the way Peter Hart was on the Democratic side.
Right. And so I was, you know, the young kid in the corner and kept my mouth shut and my ears and eyes open and learned a ton in the 3 years I was in Detroit. And then I left Market Opinion Research and went back to Boston to work for Ray Shammy for United States Senate.
Against Ted Kennedy.
No, that was in 82. In 84, for the open seat that was ultimately won. The seat that Kerry won.
Right.
And it was that was a fun campaign where I met my third mentor, Arthur Finkelstein, who is a towering figure. And I laugh. He's a great friend still. And he really, the first time he met me, he didn't really like me because I came from his rival, Bob Teeter. And
Arthur Finkelstein was sort of he was on the conservative end of the Republican Party. Interesting guy, very flamboyant personality, and kind of take no prisoners sort of pollster.
He had a very different approach than Mr. Teeter. And Arthur, though, he's so brilliant, and he's mentored so many people who are prominent in the field today. We had a party for him in New York a couple years ago, just all his acolytes. And it was a roast, but it was an amazing room full of people. And what I learned from Arthur really was an entirely different way to read polls. So I feel like I learned how to read polls from two of the masters in two very different ways.
Was he more strategic or?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't pull tables. Mm-hmm. He just like threw the book of crosstabs at you, and then he'd go through the crosstabs, you know. Mm-hmm. He would have gone through them first, and then he'd say, turn to page 176 and look at this little piece, and you're going to see something interesting. And that was a really different way. I mean, and I said to him after my first meeting, everything you just did makes so much sense to me. And we've been great friends since.
And I want to stop guessing, but I know that you went to law school and you practiced law for a while and raised kids.
Yeah. I went down to Texas to work for Bill Clements in 86 in the rematch against Mark White, where he won. And then I went to law school, met my husband. And my intention was just to go down to Texas and then go back to Boston, but I met my husband and went to law school at SMU and worked at Akin Gump for a few years. And then we did go back to Boston. I worked in state government there as the chief of staff to the state treasurer. And then took a break and did the most important job that I ever did, which was being a full-time mom.
And got coaxed out of that by Mitt Romney.
Yes, after 5 years of happy stay-at-home mom.
Blissful parenting, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
And in fact, Mitt had asked me if I would run his campaign for governor in 2002, and I declined.
Did you know him?
I had met him in 94 when he ran for Senate. And, you know, everyone in Boston knew Mitt Romney. He was sort of one of the most well-known figures around town. He'd worked at Bain Consulting. Mm-hmm. He started Bain Capital. And yeah, I mean, he and Ann were very prominent civic figures. But no, I didn't know him well. I kind of laughed because I told him, no, I can't run your campaign. I'm a full-time mom. And, but I'll help you out. And he basically gave me the keys to his house while he went back to Utah. And I went through a lot of his things in his basement from his old campaign and set up a few things until he hired his campaign manager and brought on Mike Murphy as a consultant. I laid the groundwork. And then I disappeared for months until he was doing debate prep. And he put a big emphasis on debate prep because he had
Kennedy had
it hadn't been one of the better
experiences. That was the sort of pivotal moment in that campaign was the Kennedy-Romney debates, where Kennedy, the old master, kind of schooled him.
He felt he needed more prep the second time around. We'll leave it at that. And so I took over that job, and he was running against a woman named Shannon O'Brien. And she was very, very on message, and I transcribed everything she said, and I would we'd do these mock debates, and I would read what she said.
Had you ever done debate prep before? Or was this something new?
Something new, and then I'd always hit him really hard, and so.
So you played Shannon O'Brien in these debates?
I played a much meaner Shannon O'Brien than the real Shannon O'Brien, and. So when Mitt
and she's pretty tough.
She's tough, but I was mean.
That's kind of the way, though. You have to do debate prep. You don't want to prepare. You kind of prepare for the worst and hope for the best.
That's right. And when they had their first debate, I kind of guessed we had done a mock debate the day before, and she had sort of three openings she gave and three closings she'd given in the primaries, and I guessed at what her opening would be and what her closing would be, and I did that the day before. And I was right. And so Mitt, she opened the debate and heard virtually exactly what I had said the night before. And that gave him, you know, he knew exactly where to go. And he had a series of good debates. And ironically, where the 94 debates, the debate with Kennedy might have impacted his race, in 2002, the debate moderated by Tim Russert with Shannon O'Brien probably tipped Mitt over the edge to victory. So then
in a state that you've had a tradition in Massachusetts of Republican and Democratic governors. I think he was in a string of Republican governors, but still not
an
easy state.
It's never an easy state.
So Mitt Romney won that election, and you were going to go back to your life.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Mitt asked to meet me, and I thought he was going to ask me to be the party chair, and he asked me to be his chief of staff, and
which is a real job.
It's a real job.
Not to denigrate party chair.
But party chair is a part-time job,
right.
And chief of staff is a full-time job.
At least, as
I reminded him, I still had those two pesky kids to take care of, and while they were old enough, and they were not giving me any trouble. I really was committed to being home in what moms know as the witching hour between 5:30 and 8:30 to do dinner and homework with them, and wasn't willing to give that up. So I said to Mitt that, you know, if he thought I could be an effective chief of staff, I would probably be the first person in the office in the morning because I'm an early person, but that I'd have to leave the office at 5 o'clock every day. And could he live with that? And he said, let's give it a whirl. And I'm not sure it would have worked for every office holder, but it worked for Mitt and me. And I did that for almost 4 years. And I don't think there were more than a handful of times that I couldn't live up to my commitment of leaving to take care of my kids.
What was it like? What was it like working with him?
It was great. I mean, it was very clear what he wanted my job as chief of staff to be. And that was to make sure he got the information to make the decisions from the secretariats, got both sides of the issue. So if there was a problem, he didn't want to hear what everybody thought was the solution. He wanted to hear the pros and the cons.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we did was sometimes we found out that bad ideas were presented well and good ideas were presented poorly. So we had an in-house policy group that if we were going to discuss an issue, both sides had to bring it through to our policy group so that the pros and cons were presented in a fair way to Mitt. And that sort of resonated later to when I was doing the VP vetting. I felt that it was
when
the same
for president.
Yeah, that it was the same. It was the same task that he wanted me to do, to be a fair arbiter and make sure that all of that he didn't want me to make a decision or even have an opinion necessarily as in that role. But bring the information to him.
And then would he consult with you after?
Oh, sure. I mean, he was always interested in opinions, but
he wanted you to run the process.
But he was mostly interested in making sure that all sides were heard from.
So I think back to Mitt Romney in that period of time, and he was kind of your classic moderate Republican in many ways. I mean, there was a local sort of cap and trade thing going on in the Northeast.
Reggie.
He was he took a moderate position on issues like gun control, even on abortion, about which I'm sure he had very strong feelings. But he was governing a state with he dealt with all of that. The reason I ask you that is because it seemed that he needed to figure, and he of course famously did health reform in Massachusetts and developed a health exchange there. It seems like he had to kind of contend with the Republican Party nationally that was different than the Republican Party in Massachusetts. And that was a challenge as he moved forward as a presidential candidate in 2008.
Yeah, I think Mitt Romney was an unlikely presidential candidate. It was not a natural fit for a northerner, somewhat moderate governor of a blue state to be the standard bearer for a party that was southern and more conservative than perhaps he was. But
his dad was quite, actually, you know, by today's standards, was quite progressive as governor of Michigan, George Romney.
You know, you also forget that we had a lot of things that happened that gave Mitt an opportunity to really voice his position in the conservative world. Gay marriage started in Massachusetts, and Mitt was opposed. That was a big deal. I mean, he was opposed, but his mandate to me was to make sure that that it was executed well, that it was going to happen, and that there was nothing really to stop, no way to stop it. It had to, I think we had 90 days or 120 days to execute it. And there were a lot of things that the Supreme Court mandate was for the legislature to make such laws as to and make this happen. They enacted zero laws. So it was all done through the executive. And, you know, I'm pretty proud of the way we handled that, because even though the governor was opposed to it and made no bones about that, you would have to look hard to find any gay couple that felt that their rights were trampled on in Massachusetts.
But conservatives probably looked at that, what you would, and I think rightly so, portray as fair-minded governance, would look at that and say, gee, he didn't do enough to obstruct this. He didn't.
Well, there was definitely a group that felt that the Supreme Court didn't have the right to do what they did. That was a pretty small
The Massachusetts Supreme Court.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But most conservatives viewed Mitt's opposition and attempt to do a ballot petition and work legislatively to make changes that were necessary.
Do you think, did he shift at all during the last years of his governorship as he thought about running for president?
No. Shift on that issue?
Not on that issue. On I mean, when you're about to run for president, if you're a governor, I'm sure that things come, particularly governor of Massachusetts, where you have to take that into account.
Yeah, but the issues, for instance, healthcare. I mean, I think one of the things that Mitt wanted to do to make sure that happened before he considered a run for presidency is that he left an impact on the state.
And worked closely with Ted Kennedy, actually.
Very closely with Ted Kennedy, and it was sort of a perfect time to make that happen in Massachusetts because of our unique situation with an obscure thing called the uncompensated care pool. And a waiver that we got for Medicaid, and the fact that we had a senior senator with enough clout and a Health and Human Services secretary that Mitt was good friends with and willing to work with, Mike Leavitt. So there was this really unique situation, and we had a problem that we looked at for a year before Mitt committed to doing it. We looked at it and said, "Can we solve this?" And the answer was yes, we could solve it for Massachusetts.
When it became, when he ran for president in 2012, that became an issue for him within the Republican Party, because the truth is, there were aspects of that Massachusetts plan that really were a model, and a lot, and there were people who worked on the Massachusetts plan who Obama recruited, the president I worked for, because of their expertise. Mm-hmm. But it was it created an awkward situation for him within the Republican primary.
You know, it's funny. Mitt never ever took a step back from the fact that what he did in Massachusetts worked for Massachusetts, but he also strongly believed, and probably, and I'm sure still to this day believes, that the Massachusetts plan and as it turned into Obamacare was not the right solution for the country.
Do you just one thing I shouldn't let fly by on the gay marriage issue is, years later, you signed an amicus brief along with a lot of other Republican mm-hmm. leaders in favor of gay marriage. You must have had that view then. How did you work those issues through when you guys were talking about it? Obviously, he's the governor, so he has 99.9% of the voting shares. But
I didn't sign that brief till I was not working for
right,
him
of course.
Longer. I think when you work for somebody, you don't agree with them on every single issue, and you have to decide if that issue is so important to you that you have to step away. In this case, you know, I was able to reconcile that with his position with my position and work fine in the administration. But then when I was no longer working for Mitt, I signed the brief, and I'm happy that I did.
So 2012, I was on one side and you were on the other side. The primary campaign, it seemed to me that it was a kind of very, it would be what I would used to call a crazy primary until this year.
Yeah.
When that seemed like a placid stroll in the park. But, in order to win that primary, he took a series of positions, one on immigration, so that ended up haunting him. So how hard was it to come through that Republican primary process in a position to actually compete and win a general election?
Well, issues were one thing, tactics were another. I mean, and campaign finance was a third. The way the money flows in primaries, taking the issues first of all. We had to play hardball, and we never, this year I heard a lot of people talk about candidates being in their lane or not being in their lane. When we were running in 2012, everyone was in our lane. We had to get through strong candidacies of Rick Perry, Tim Pawlenty, Newt Gingrich, Senator Santorum, and we played hardball in all of those, and we were very strategic on how could we juxtapose Mitt and his positions against those people, and we did it, and we did it aggressively in the debates. I think there were 22. I may
yes.
be off. Those debates were hard on, and there was a lot of wear and tear to do 22 debates. You remember that from 2008. But they hardened
him. I think
we did
25.
Yeah, it's
brutal.
You know, your mind goes a little crazy. But we went into every single debate with a strategy against one or more of his opponents who was stronger or weaker in the polls. And we pushed through that. It went on longer. So the creation of super PACs in 2012. Kept a couple candidates who probably would have starved to death under 20, the
right.
without a
Sheldon
super PAC.
Sheldon Adelson gave $10 million to a Newt Gingrich
yeah.
PAC.
Yeah.
That kept Newt going.
Kept him going.
Rick Santorum had a supporter who kept him going through his super
right.
PAC. Yeah. But, when I was sitting on the other side, I watched those debates, obviously, pretty carefully. And when I saw, you know, for example, when Romney was going up against Rick Perry on the immigration issue and did the self-deportation thing and so on, I thought, this is going to hurt in the general election. And it did hurt in the general election. And the reason I ask is not to rehash old history. It just speaks to, it seems to me, how difficult it is to come through, particularly maybe now more in the Republican Party than the Democratic Party at this juncture in history. That's not to say in the past or in the future wouldn't be different, but to come through the primary process in a way that you can win a general election.
It's hard, but it's not impossible. You did it in 2008. You came through a brutal primary process.
But we didn't have to take positions that compromised us in the general election. You know, in fact, Obama sort of ran to the right of some of the
candidates. Well, we may see that happen this year with Senator Clinton having to move more to the left with Bernie Sanders. So, you know, again, primaries, your point is very well taken. Primaries push candidates to the ends of the spectrum, and the general election.
Did you talk about that at all? Were you guys worried about it?
I mean, self-deportation wasn't something that we practiced in debate prep, but sometimes candidates say things that
people these are human beings,
and
everybody makes sort of mistakes, and you know, that's the first thing you got to know when you're doing presidential races.
I knew exactly.
Organizations make mistakes. Operatives make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. It's a pressure-filled process.
I knew exactly what he was talking about. It wasn't exactly the way he the most articulate way to put forward that position, and it was misinterpreted. But you know, I think.
Did you do what I sometimes did, like in Denver, when we were debating? Did you kind of wince when you heard it?
You know, as Matt Rhodes, the campaign manager, said, we'll need some cleanup on that.
Matt's a guy of understatement. Yes.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, we you know, we knew what we had to do in the spin room afterwards. But look, you had to win the primary. And it was a long time. That was in September, the primary. We were still doing debates up until, like, I broke my arm in February. And
not in debate prep.
But I was going to debate. So it was March or so. I mean, I was at debate preps with my broken arm. So I know it had to be like in March that we had our last one. So we were doing these debates for months and months and months and months. Yeah. And then, you know, we got out of the primary season pretty worn out. The troops were looking for some refreshment. And you guys were in a position to take advantage of that tactically because one, we were worn out. Two, we'd spent a lot of money, and the mechanics of raising general election money required us to scramble.
You wound up raising quite a bit, but not in the time frame that you needed to. And it gave us the chance to sort of define the race and define Governor Romney before he could define the race and define himself.
Right. I mean, we were having anvils dropped on our heads, and you were doing it in two ways. I mean, every morning at 10 o'clock, I had a strategy meeting in my office, and we would see exactly what was on the air, pro and con, where it was on, and we looked at the content. And I was watching ads that were running at about 300 points a week, in early states or in the swing states that were started in the spring. And those were devastating ads to just laid the groundwork for what was to come when you were starting to go up and with heavier.
It helps when you don't have a primary. I mean, the fact is that Obama didn't have primary competition, and it gave him a great advantage in that race. I want to talk about one more thing about 2012, and then I want to talk about where we are today. You probably would rather talk about 2012 a little longer, But
let's keep that going.
I mentioned Denver. That going into that Denver debate in 2012, you'd had the 47% comment by Romney that was on tape. That was very devastating. We come into that debate. What was the sense within your camp going into that debate And how did you prepare for that debate? I mean, we obviously didn't prepare very well. So let me just assert that right from the start. I've talked about that a lot.
We knew that it was an existential moment for the campaign. And fortunately, we had started preparing that for the debates way back in June.
Yeah. And so had we. I wish it had worked better for us.
We were, and actually I was managing that process. Stuart Stevens was sort of the mitt whisperer, but I put the structure to it. And we did a lot. We were ready to go into that debate. Yes, September was not a good month, but Mitt is a very focused thinker, and he knew what he had to do, and he knew, just like in the primaries, when he'd walk on those stages, he knew what he had to deliver, and he did it.
I know I've talked with Stuart and some other folks from your camp, but you knew. You had a good sense of what Obama was going to do. I guess Rob Portman played him in
the Rob was brilliant.
Senator from Ohio. We started off with what turned out to be a disastrous opening in which the president acknowledged that it was his anniversary. And you guys doped that all out, right?
Yeah. We had one of the people who was on our debate, Peter Flaherty, had come up, had said, "Hey, look, guys, you know this is the president's anniversary.
20th anniversary.
We got to be ready with this." And so we were. And again, I give that.
The president came out and threw essentially verbal bouquets to Michelle. And Mitt was ready with a line.
With a line. And
that's what debates really are remembered for, are those lines.
And it was a gracious line.
It was.
And but it was funny.
I think he said, "I'm sure this is exactly how you would hope to spend your anniversary right here with me."
And so it was, you know, we back in the green room, we were sort of already, we were high-fiving on the first moment.
Yeah.
But that, you know, as well as that debate went, it's, you know, when you're standing backstage, debates are, you know, they're gut-clenching.
Yeah, yeah, they are. Well, that one was particularly for us, 10 minutes in. If we weren't in an inside room in an arena, I would have looked for a window to jump out of, but there was none available. So, Beth, I know that you care deeply about the Republican Party, and you care even more so about the country. Explain to me what's going on in your party right now.
Oh, boy. You know, look, I think that there's a lot of people, a lot of Americans, who are angry, and who feel that their government has not delivered for them. I think that's both true of people in the Democrat Party and the Republican Party. And we heard some of that in 2012 and 2008, and I don't think we listened carefully enough. And they're making their voices known. They are unhappy with the way things are going. They're unhappy with the Republican establishment. And it looked like the party elders on both sides were going to put before the voters another rematch of Clinton and Bush. And the voters said, "No, we're not going to do that." And
you were a supporter of Bush.
I was a supporter of Jeb Bush.
Well, it's fair to say you are part of the party establishment.
I guess after all these years, I am. And I think Jeb Bush would have been an excellent president, not to be. So what we're seeing is also, you know, it's sort of a change from the conservative movement that I was part of and enervated by, which was really unified with foreign policy. There was an economic side, a foreign policy side, and a social conservative side. And I think the foreign policy part held it together. And during the George W. Bush years, that started to come apart. And so the party is not as cohesive as it was when I was a younger person and coming up through the party ranks.
I mean, it seems like you've got really, really distinct factions, social conservatives, these populists who really were the base for Trump, and then center right, kind of more corporate
we've
oriented.
And Donald Trump, who will be the nominee, has got his work cut out for him in trying to unify the Republican Party and bring in independent voters and create a winning coalition in enough states that he can win 271 electoral votes.
No one has been more outspoken about this than Mitt Romney, who's really been ferocious in his opposition to Trump. And, you know, said in an interview recently in the Wall Street Journal that his son Josh said to him, what are you going to tell your grandchildren about what you did about Donald Trump, to stop Donald Trump? And he is unapologetic about that, feels it's a matter of conscience that what do people like you do? And how did you, first of all, how did you react to that? Did you talk to him about it?
I talked to him at length about it, and I'm very comfortable with his position. He feels that he's putting country over party, and that to me makes sense. He couldn't do it any other way and put his head on a pillow at night, and so I'm completely supportive of that position. I decided that I wasn't going to play in a presidential race.
I was going to ask you how you're sleeping.
Yeah, I'm sleeping just fine. look, I did two presidential races in a row. It took a lot out of me, and I'm very happy to work on some down ballot races this year.
Meaning Senate races.
Senate races, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Trump for a second, though. As someone who cares, no, I mean, it's, I know you're grimacing here, but I mean,
I'm smiling.
Smiling. Smiling with a little bit of a grimace. But does he represent you? I mean, does he represent the Republican Party as far as you're concerned? I know I know you're a lawyer. Don't tell me he's the nominee, I know. But I mean, in terms of what you see as the Republican Party, does he reflect that, and are you comfortable with it?
Well, he clearly reflects the voters who voted in the Republican primaries. He showed strongly in many, many states. And, you know, the voters were heard. Does he reflect my visions of America and the Republican Party? No. But
do you think he's equipped to be president?
Yes.
Okay. Let the record show that you gave it a lot of thought.
Yeah.
Before you answer that question,
I think he's a different, very different candidate, and we will see.
You're pro trade, probably pro immigration reform, as Bush was.
Yeah, I mean, look, the immigration system is completely broken, and it has to be fixed. I'm not sure that I would agree with our nominee's way of fixing it, but he definitely articulates a feeling that a lot of Americans share.
You've also been really, and I'll get off this in a second, but I'm just, you know, you've been someone who, I came to know you after the election. We became great friends. You're on the board of the Institute of Politics. I deeply, deeply respect you and how you approach public life and so on. And one of the things I respect is your openness to diverse voices. One of the things that concerns me, not as a partisan, but just as an American, is this sort of harsh kind of divisiveness that we've heard. Is that something that concerns you?
Yes, of course it is. And you know, when I look back at the people that I grew up with in politics, you know, look at Bob Teeter. I mean, we looked at, he said politics is a profession, it's an honorable profession, and we also have to treat everybody with respect. We're not going to agree with everyone. And I always think that that is the best way to try to find, and you and I have talked about this, try to find the common grounds you have with people that you may disagree with in your party, and that you may disagree with across the aisle, because finding those common grounds will move us forward as a country. Not everyone's going to be happy with that, but you have to seek that out. And you have to find friendship and camaraderie across the aisle and within the party, even if you don't agree. This year, there has been less of that than ever on both sides. And
well, Trump just attacked Susana Martinez, the governor of New Mexico, who's the head of Governors Association, Republican Governors Association, in very, very harsh terms. I mean, that's...
It's very unfortunate. And Governor Martinez is a successful governor and also part of a coalition, women and Latinas, that our party needs in order to win in November.
Let me ask you, you're doing these Senate races and you're involved in states that are competitive. Are you worried about the effect that Trump is going to have on your candidates?
You know, I think it's always, presidential years are always, I'm working in two states that are swing states, and those are always tougher years.
New Hampshire and Ohio.
Yeah, and those are really tough years to run in when you're either a Republican or a Democrat. It's always much more of a jump ball.
And well, is he going to make it harder or easier?
I don't know. I think Donald Trump lost in Ohio in the Ohio primary to Governor Kasich, but he won in New Hampshire. So in some states, I think he'll show very strongly. And in others, maybe less so. But anytime there's someone at the top of the ticket, you know, there's pros and cons.
Yeah. I was struck by Kelly Ayotte's handling of the Trump question because she said, well, I support him, but I don't endorse him. And it just, to me, underscored sort of the difficulty that his candidacy is posing for a lot of Republicans in that he's the top of the ticket, chosen by the voters, and yet there's some level of discomfort with them.
Yeah, and Speaker Ryan had the same ambivalence, and today he endorsed
Donald Trump.
And look, when change happens, people have to give it some thought. And change is absolutely happening in the Republican Party. I think at Thanksgiving we'll know a little bit better whether this was change for the good or change for the bad.
Well, let me ask you something about yourself. Since we've gotten to know each other and since we've become friends, you went through a health issue that was pretty serious, and you confronted as we all do at time. Eventually the issues of mortality. And so
right.
Has that changed your view of politics at all? Does it change the way you approach politics or?
Probably. First of all, it definitely made me not want to get on airplanes and run around at the speed of light.
Killer life,
for
man.
Yeah, I mean, I had a stroke in August of 2014. In the middle, I was working on a couple races then, and I was very fortunate that it really didn't leave me with any deficits, but it did uncover that I have a brain disease that leads me prone to having more brain bleeds in the future or not. I try to live a much healthier lifestyle, and living a healthy lifestyle does not allow me to work on a presidential campaign, because as you know, it's probably the least healthy lifestyle when you get several hours of sleep a day for months on end, and stress levels are really high. And
I gained about 30 pounds during the 2008. I almost had my own zip code by the end of that campaign. So yes, I know what you're talking about.
But yeah, I think what you're asking me, does it change the way the seriousness? And I look more towards the future and the urgency of making sure we get this country right. The American experiment is a really tricky thing.
I think as we're testing.
Right, but it's been tested many times
over and
before.
Over, yes.
And every time that the American experiment has been tested in the past, it's worked. And it works because there's a compact between the people that we always are going to do the right thing for the country. And when push comes to shove, we all rise to that occasion.
Yeah.
And making sure that we're still doing that is really important. I saw the play Hamilton, as corny as that sounds.
Great?
And, it reminds the brilliance of that play in pointing out that this was a crazy idea, this country,
right.
And that there was no guarantee that it was going to work. And that somehow Americans who are as different as you and I are in our beliefs have pulled together consistently to make it work. When your mortality flashes before your eyes, first thing you think of course, is your family.
Right.
But when things settle down a little, the importance of giving your all to things that matter and are going to leave a lasting mark in the world are important. And American democracy is high on my list.
I think what I also think, I always think about the sacrifices that my family has made for my involvement in politics. And we've gone through health issues ourselves that were pretty serious. When you do these things, as you point out, they're very, very important and they're all enveloping. And then things like this happen and you say, you know what, they're actually, you know, as important as those things are, I've got great kids, I've got a wonderful family, and I've got a finite amount of time. And
where you put that matters a lot more. I spent a lot more time than I did before was in spiritual contemplation. Mm-hmm. And, when I was working in a presidential campaign, never had time for that. And that was a huge mistake that, you always have to have time for that. It does, putting that, the reprioritization of my life.
But the other part is true too. It does remind you that there are bigger things than what generally dominates the debate that we see on television these days. There are real consequences to these decisions. As you point out, democracy is a fragile thing. America's been incredibly durable. But these are challenging times. So we should leave it at your essentially your prayer there, which is that the American people always pull through at the end and do what's right.
Absolutely,
and do what they think is right.
And I think they don't always get it right, but
I think they take it pretty seriously in the end.
We might go off track a little bit, but as a people, we've shown this remarkable ability to pull it together. So I have faith that it'll happen.
Well, one of the things that strengthens my faith, which is pretty deep in all of this, is to get to know people like you with whom I have disagreements, but who I admire so much. And it's been a real gift to get to know you after the last campaign, and I'm so grateful for what you've done for the Institute of Politics on our board, as a fellow, as a role model for a lot of our students. So, Beth Myers, thank you so much.
Thank you. You're very gracious, and I've enjoyed my involvement with the University of Chicago to the nth degree, and thank you for having me here.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.